With all the national news stories about sexual assault, more and more survivors are speaking out and looking for help. What's available here to people in Illinois? Also, earlier this year, Superintendent Dan Cox got the first payments from the state under a new funding formula that spent more money on school districts that need it. Here's what he told us back then.
This is definitely a day for celebration for us. We have the opportunity to see the realization of the hard work that went into passing the evidence-based funding formula.
6 months later, we check back in. And if you've turned on the TV, you've probably gotten used to reports like this.
It'll be off the coast in not that long, but you can see those deep reds and oranges in the radar in central Virginia, and that's where the real danger is.
That's CBS News weather reporter David Parkinson. We'll talk with the U of I scientist about hurricanes, tropical storms, and if they're getting worse. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we'll be spotlighting some Illinois organizations that work with sexual assault survivors. An Illinois atmospheric scientist joins us to talk tropical storms, and we'll ask how an alligator ended up in Lake Michigan. But first, last year, state lawmakers went back and forth for months over how to change the way Illinois funds its K-12 public schools. Republicans and Democrats dragged the debate on for so long, the state actually missed some of its first payments to public schools. But eventually, our state government did deliver on its promise, and a recent report found that it's working. In the first year of the new formula, the state is, in fact, sending newly allocated resources and funding to the districts that need it the most. We talked to so many different school districts during this process about what a hard time they were having. We wanted to check back in with them now on a happier note. And joining me now is Dan Cox, superintendent of Staunton Community Unit Number 6. That's about 45 minutes northeast of St. Louis. Kristen Humphreys is also on the line. He's superintendent of East Moline School District 37. Gentlemen, welcome back to the 21st. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Superintendent Cox, let's start with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing outstanding. Thanks for asking.
Why is that?
Well, this year we've been off to a positive start, the most positive we've had in quite some time. And I know people say that money doesn't always make a difference, but in our cases, the schools, especially over the last decade, having the evidence-based funding formula in place has made a significant difference for our schools.
Superintendent Humphreys, what about for you in East Moline?
Yeah, we're going to echo the same story in East Moline. It's really changed the way we look. Our district leadership team now, when we get together, or our Board of Education, we have conversations. We talk about what supports we can add for our students rather than cutting. It's been life-changing for our kids.
Mm. Superintendent Cox, in the past we've talked about how hard the beginning of the school year is. How was this year different for you all?
I would agree with Superintendent Humphreys. Now, for the first time in a long time, we're having conversations about where we can drive our dollars that have the greatest impact on our student learning versus recommending where we can cut and do the least harm. And right away, our students and teachers have seen an immediate impact on the results of the funding that we've put in, that's been put into place.
What examples can you give me in terms of immediate impact?
Sure. At the start of this current school year, the district was able to hire 8 instructional employees. 5 of those were teachers and 3 were paraprofessionals. The positions that were added drive the resources where they're needed most. For example, we used those positions to reduce class size, provide academic and behavioral interventions, provide social and emotional supports for students. Some other things that we're doing is increasing our family engagement. We've bolstered some school safety, working on social-emotional learning, and providing instructional resources to our classrooms is another area that we've been able to enhance and have significant areas of improvement.
Superintendent Humphreys, I wonder if you can tell us as well, in terms of your district, I wonder if you can remind us a little bit about your district and what its financial situation was before the new formula took effect?
Absolutely. We're about 2,800 students. We're an elementary district here in the Quad Cities. We feed into a neighboring high school, United Township High School. Approximately 99% of our students are free and reduced. We speak over 40 languages in the East Moline School District. And we have a very, we're approaching 25% EL now in East Moline, which means English learners, which is, obviously they speak a different language than English at home. We have kindergarten classrooms in East Moline where nobody speaks English and nobody speaks Spanish. We are that diverse. And And obviously the last 10 years have been very difficult on our school district. I've been superintendent for 9 years now here in East Moline, and until last year, we had not known a year where we were not cutting due to proration in the state of Illinois. So this has absolutely changed our mindset on what the possibilities might be for the future for our students, much like they have in Staunton. We've looked at the model, the elements that are recommended in the evidence-based model, and we've tried to drive our dollars there to support our students to get, you know, the biggest bang for our buck and impact both academic achievement and social-emotional support for our students.
And I do want to talk to both of you about the possibilities, but Superintendent Humphreys, I wanted to just ask you, just go back to something you said. So if you have kindergarten classes that are EL, English learning, and they're not kids who are speaking Spanish at home, what other languages are they?
We have a lot of West African languages. We have some East African languages. We have languages from Southeast Asia. We've got languages all over the world, Nyala, and in East Moline, you know, we're proud of our diversity, and we're really proud of that their families entrust their students to us, but we want to make sure that we have the dollars to lift our students up and support them so they can be productive members of our community upon graduation.
Superintendent Cox, what about you in Southern Illinois? Can you tell us a little bit about your district and what the formula looked like for you all before?
Well, we were in a complete crisis mode. We have approximately 1,300 students. We're a unit district where we're all on one campus. And while we do not have the diversity of East Moline, we certainly have various needs, especially when it comes to our social-emotional learning and the poverty. We had been running a deficit in our district since 2009. We have a $14 million a year budget. It was reduced down to about $10 million a year, and we still had $1 million deficit. So those were some significant numbers we were facing, and it caused us to work from what I would call a scarcity mentality. We were doing the best we could to maintain our programs and services while looking for ways to raise our revenue, to look for efficiencies, renew contracts, renegotiate contracts, all those type of things so we could do as little harm to student learning as possible. And our staff, I applaud them, did a phenomenal job of that. Now today, our funding is up almost an additional $1 million. We're still a Tier 1 district, and with the dollars that we received, we moved from 58% to 60% of adequacy, and we've just been able to do phenomenal work right out of the gate with that this year, and it's just almost like it's a complete 180. We know we still have a lot of work to do to fully fund our schools, but we're certainly thankful for the opportunity we have before us, and we're going to make the most of that.
And when we think about the possibilities, Superintendent Cox, I wonder, when you talk about it, sounds like it's been a whole mindset change. And I think sometimes it's hard. I imagine it must have taken a toll on even morale to be in a place of constantly cutting. Is it weird to think, I wonder if you've been able to fully shift to, we actually do have more money now?
It's a communication that we have. You know, it's about how we communicate that. And you are right. We have had what I just described as a scarcity mentality, and in conversations we've had with staff, we are still conscientious about how we make decisions. The same as in East Moline, we've used the evidence-based funding tool and used what we call a gap analysis report to look at where we are in terms of staffing and services that we offer our kids and where we can drive our dollars to have the most bang for our buck. We've overlaid those conversations about finances with our teachers and within our district improvement team to look at the quality framework that's the guide we're using for school improvement. And so we have those. We've now interwoven the financial discussions and the academic discussions together, and that's given our teachers a mindset of, okay, there's dollars here, but we want to strategically use them because we know they're not unlimited resources, so we certainly want to drive the dollars where they're needed the most first and then work from there.
We're talking with two school superintendents. That's Dan Cox. He's superintendent of Staunton, Illinois Community Unit number 6. Kristen Humphreys is also with us. He's superintendent of East Moline School District 37. Superintendent Humphreys, what kind of difference has, what does morale look like? I'm thinking particularly among your teachers and other staff at schools this year.
I think the morale's been greatly improved. I mean, we're really excited about what the possibilities are. And as school leaders and teachers, our job is to make sure that our legislators understand just how important it is to continue to drive these dollars toward education. And we're going to, our job is to deliver on those outcomes and show them that the model is working as intended. So it's changed some things. It's changed the mindset. Now we talk about what the future will look like rather than what we may have to cut or the least harm we can do to students. And it's just been a big mindset change in East Moline.
Do you feel like so much was cut that it's going to take you, how long, I wonder, do you think it will take to recover from all of the years of cutting? We're talking about 6 good months right now, compared to, as you both have been going back almost a decade in terms of talking about cuts. Superintendent Humphreys?
Yeah, I think, honestly, as long as we continue to fund the model and drive dollars to education, I think the corner is going to be turning here in the next 2 to 4 years for East Moline schools. Right now, we're basically, before we were running deficit spending on, fund balances that were precariously low, but now we're at least able to run a balanced budget. But if we continue to drive dollars to the model in the next 2 to 4 years, I believe that we'll be changing the way we internally feel about the future of education here in the state of Illinois, just right here in East Moline.
And what about you, Superintendent Cox? What about for Staunton?
I agree with Superintendent Humphreys, and the return on investment is going to take time, but I don't think it's going to take as long as what one may think. While we were struggling significantly since I'd mentioned 2009, with the dollars being pushed into schools now through the formula, I think you'll see that recovery happen very quickly. I'm just looking at what we've done from last year to this year, moving from 58% of adequacy to 60% of adequacy. We have a long way to go to become fully funded. That being said, we've done tremendous work here early on that's had an immediate impact for our kids. When we talk with our stakeholders and more so the lawmakers who are making decisions to fund the formula, I would just certainly encourage them that to understand that the return on investment is going to take time. And what I mean by that is, an example, most of the areas we have focused on have to do with interventions, especially in reading and math, for our elementary and junior high age students. So that's going to take some time as well to see that come out in what you would see on our report card or in scores. But it's certainly changed the mindset. It's changed morale, and we need to continue to be committed to fund the formula and increase funding within the formula.
What would it take, Superintendent Cox, for you all to be fully funded?
We're running about 60% of adequacy. So we would need about $14 million to be fully funded.
And what about you, Superintendent Humphreys?
It would take another $15 million to be fully funded in East Moline. And when you think about the first year, we received $1.2 million more in new funding. This year, we're receiving $900,000 in new funding. So that's $2.1 million. We still have $15 million to go in East Moline. So the hill is steep. There's still a lot of work to be done, but if we commit to this, the work's important, and I know that it will pay off in the long run for the kids all across the state.
It's election time. We hear lots of people running for office and talking about the importance of public education. What message do you have, both for candidates as well as for our state lawmakers, about what you want them to know about your situation right now? Superintendent Cox, let's start with you.
We're very appreciative of the collaborative effort by everyone that was involved in passing the evidence-based funding formula. But also on that same line, we have underfunded the formula the first two opportunities we've had. We've received $350 million in the formula last year as a state. This year it was $300 million because of the property tax relief fund. And we recognize and do celebrate and applaud the effort to make that happen, but the work isn't done. The work has just begun. We still need to have conversations about how we can add dollars to that formula and get our districts closer to adequacy so we can meet the goal to fully fund our schools.
And what about you, Superintendent Humphreys?
I would echo that statement, and I would add that I really do applaud our legislators for thinking long term and thinking about the future of the state of Illinois. But I encourage them strongly to get into our schools and see what's going on and see the hard work being done by our teachers, by our paraprofessionals, by our school principals, and know that this work is important and we're doing everything we can to lift up our kids, and it will pay benefits. But we need you to get involved, we need you to be informed, and we need you to continue to fund this formula.
And what would be on your wish list, Superintendent Humphreys, if you could have one?
As a wish list as far as
funding, yeah.
Well, actually, fully funding would be wonderful. We realize that's not going to happen overnight, but continuing to fund the model as intended would just be amazing. $350 million per year to add to the formula is what the legislature has committed to. Superintendent Cox has talked about this already. They came up $50 million short this past year. But my wish list is continue to fund the formula and allow us to do our jobs and go to work and make a difference for the kids across the state.
Right. So that's a reminder for lawmakers, but also for all of the citizens and residents who are listening that, while some good work has happened, it's not yet finished, it sounds like.
No, we're not even close. We've just started, but it's important work, and it's exciting times right now for educators in the state of Illinois when it comes to the change that Illinois has made to the evidence-based funding.
Well, it's nice to speak with you, gentlemen, and have a happier story than we have had in the past. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. Kristen Humphreys is superintendent of East Moline School District 37. Dan Cox is the superintendent of Staunton, a community unit number 6. Thank you for both being with me. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be talking about how different agencies across Illinois who work with survivors of sexual assault have been responding to recent conversations offering help. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st.
Support comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a talk by Professor James Anderson, Citizenship, Immigration, and National Identity, Civic Education on the Sesquicentennial Anniversary of the 14th Amendment, Wednesday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. More at cas.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In recent months, we've been having a lot of conversations about consent and about how to approach narratives of sexual assault. There are some who strongly abide by the philosophy of believed survivors, others who would say innocent until proven guilty. But regardless of what you think about the stories of sexual assault, this is a reality that millions of women and men face. The day after Dr. Christine Blasey Ford shared her story of sexual assault in congressional testimony, calls to the National Sexual Assault Hotline went up 147%. People were asking for help. But what if you're in Illinois? What's available to you? And that's the conversation we're about to have with a couple of folks. Joining us from our partner station, WGLT in Normal, are Gabe Kripe, the Director of Community Outreach at Stepping Stones. That's a sexual assault program at the McLean County YMCA. Brendan Wall is also with us. He's the president of Students Ending Rape Culture at Illinois State University. And on the line from DeKalb, we have Linnea Erickson-Liskowski, the Director of Communication and Prevention Services at Safe Passage. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi there. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having
Thank
us.
You so much.
Gabe, I wondered if we can start with you. I mentioned Stepping Stones. That's a program for sexual assault and abuse victims in McLean County at the YMCA. Have you all been busier in the past few weeks?
Yeah, we definitely have been pretty busy the last few weeks, not only having clients reach out to us, but also seeing an increase in people reaching out for prevention education for their classrooms or to help facilitate discussions on the topic. So I'd say across the board, from our counselors to our advocates to our educators, we have seen an uptick in need for our services over the last couple of weeks.
Linnea, what about you and DeKalb with Safe Passage?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen an increase in the number of people calling our crisis hotline when they're triggered or to talk about coping as they deal with what they see in the news and in our culture on a daily basis, especially the last few weeks. But again, also an increase in requests for our prevention services, our education. And we're just seeing an increase, especially in the schools with the students we work with, in students who are talking about, and students who are asking questions about what they're seeing in the news and what they're hearing on a daily basis and how it affects them and their survivor life.
And speaking of students, Brendan, what has it been like for you on the ISU campus with CERC?
So with CERC, we've seen kind of a lot of students who are wondering kind of for guidance on where resources are available on campus. You know, there's a lot of people on a college campuses that are paid to be available as resources for survivors, and a lot of students don't really know where they can go and who they can talk to. So we've seen really kind of a peak in students wondering, who do I have to talk to? Who can I speak with about maybe an assault or that experience that I experienced, or like maybe something that a friend and told me? How do I deal with that and cope with that? So especially in this kind of day and age, we've seen that a really big increase in that. So.
Yeah, and Brendan, Linnea mentioned the word triggering. I think we've heard this a lot, and I wonder what this means for you in your context as you are thinking about fellow students, both in and out of CERC, who are perhaps hearing all of the stories in Washington, listening maybe to Dr. Ford's testimony. What does that word mean to you, and how do you all work with survivors who are experiencing this?
So yeah, something that we've kind of seen with the idea of triggering is a lot of what you see in social media, there's not a lot of content warning. A lot of people repost articles and stuff that's talking very deeply about the details of an assault that may have happened to another person. And for a lot of survivors and allies even, it can be really frustrating to read that and not really have any warning to like what they're about to like take in terms of information. So that can be really frustrating. So in terms of that, we just really need to be consciously aware of what we're posting, I think, is the most important thing. But for students, I think it's also important to know like what resources you have available and that you're able to go talk to someone about that if you feel that some information you've taken in has been kind of triggering, kind of reminding you of maybe an assault that happened or someone you know. So it's just really making sure that we are consciously aware of that, and that's what kind of CERC provides. We do a lot as a peer support network for survivors and allies, kind of providing them a space to share their story openly and kind of no judgment free zone. So I think that's really important too, is knowing that there's spaces like that available.
And Brendan, you mentioned peers. What do you think it's important? I imagine the work you're doing, obviously, when we think about the ISU campus, and we heard Gabe and Linnea talk about this, there are adults and professionals who are available. But why do you think talking with peers is an important part of this conversation too?
I think that there's always a really benefit to having someone who has also been through maybe a similar experience as you. There's a lot to be said for like empathetic people who are, you know, they know the psychology behind it and the sociology surrounding sexual violence, but there's also something to be said for people who have experienced that themselves, and through that lived experience, I think they have like a lot that they can give survivors too. You know, imparting wisdom, here is where I'm at on my journey, where are you at, how can we work together in that and kind of just work through that space. So I think it's really true for any person who's been a survivor of a trauma, that's kind of true for them too, as someone who's been through that same experience is really able to speak to it to a different degree than someone who is just more classically trained in it.
Linnea, I wanted to ask you about Safe Passage and the work that you all do at Safe Passage. You mentioned before we get to education and prevention and allies, I do want to ask what work you're doing specifically with people who are reaching out to you who are saying they need help.
Absolutely. The kind of help that people need comes in all sorts of forms. So we have a variety of different services available for survivors, whether they were a survivor of assault 20 years ago or 20 minutes ago. We have legal advocacy. Our legal advocates can assist clients with obtaining orders of protection or civil no-contact orders, or even giving them advice and direction as they think about how they're going to navigate the legal system, connecting them with lower cost or free legal service and lawyers if that's needed. We also have medical advocates who respond 24 hours a day to local emergency rooms and police departments to help survivors as they arrive in an emergency room or police department, thinking about making a report, thinking about having a rape evidence collection kit taken, and maybe needing someone to help talk them through what their rights are in that situation. And then we also have counseling available, individual and group and family, for survivors of any age, as well as for their loved ones who are wondering how they can be supportive of their loved one who's been through that trauma.
And so what happens when someone calls? I think we say the hotline number, we hear people talking about it. What happens when someone calls a hotline?
We have trained staff, trained professionals available answering that hotline 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, for whatever someone might need to call and talk about, whether that's a survivor who wants to call and get connected with services, learn how they can connect with a legal advocate, learn how they can connect with a counselor, get that counseling session set up, or whether that's someone who's just been triggered by recent news, needs to talk with someone about how they're feeling in that moment, needs to think about how they can deal with some of those triggering emotions that are going on right now, or whether that's a professional who has someone who's come into their office or come into their place of business and they're concerned and they're wondering, how do I talk with this person? What do I say? Should I be concerned about this? Maybe it's a nurse in a doctor's office who's seeing something and they're concerned and they want to know if they should say something. Or it's a teacher whose student disclosed something and they're not exactly sure how to respond. We're available for professionals as well to help them know how to be supportive to survivors that they may come across.
Right. You actually train beauty professionals to be responsive as well, Linnea?
We do. There is a recent law in Illinois that mandates that beauty professionals have training so they know how to respond to domestic violence. So we're available to offer that training to our local salons, to anyone in the area who's interested in learning, you know, how do I deal with that, particularly because that can be a very vulnerable time for someone and a time when they may be alone without their abuser around in a situation where they don't often have that opportunity. So it's a really good chance for a beautician or a beauty professional who has that sort of relationship with someone, who someone opens up to really know how to connect them with those resources.
That's Linnea Erickson-Liskowski with Safe Passage in DeKalb. I want to go back to Gabe Kripe with Stepping Stones at the McLean County YWCA. Gabe, as we've been listening to Linnea talk about the services, it sounds like there's a whole host of things, resources that people need, legal, both mental health and physical health. Is that the kind of work you also do in McLean County?
Yeah, so Stepping Stones and Safe Passage are both a part of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and so we offer the same services that Safe Passage does. I would just add that our approach and Safe Passage's approach as well is what we call a victim-centered or a client-centered approach. So when folks call the hotline, really our role in that situation is to make sure that they're aware of all of their options, make sure that they understand all of their options, and then kind of help them process and make a decision on what's best for them. So like Brendan was talking about, for some folks, the best path to healing looks like reaching out to somebody like Stepping Stones, going through counseling services. For some folks, it looks like reporting to the police and navigating the criminal justice system. For some folks, it looks like reaching out to a peer or a family member and being supported by the folks who are already in their network, who they already trust, who they already have strong relationships with. And so really, you know, what we want to do is we want to make sure that our clients are well-informed and then that they have the power to make the decisions for themselves. So sexual assault is a disempowering act. It takes power away from people. So part of our role is restoring some of that power, giving them the opportunity to dictate what services look like and what their healing process looks like.
Yeah, but when we're thinking about services, I wonder if more we're seeing more survivors coming forward for help, how that impacts resources for you all. And I'm just thinking about so much of what we heard over the past couple of years with a state budget impasse was how social service agencies and other nonprofits in this realm had a really hard time with the budget. So I'm not sure where you guys are with that.
Yeah, the state budget impasse over the last couple of years really did have an impact on us. We were able to stay afloat with federal money through the Violence Against Women Act and also the Victims of Crime Act. And so we're in a good place right now to serve the community. We have openings available for individual and group counseling. We have space in our advocacy service as well. Sometimes prevention education gets tight for us, but we are able to meet those needs as well.
Linnea, what about you in terms of budget cuts, the budget impasse? How do you guys stand in terms of your resources?
We are much in the same position as I'm sure the vast majority of sexual assault crisis centers are throughout the state. We made it through the budget crisis. It was tight, but we were committed to not having to cut our services or close our doors to any survivor that needed us. We do still have those federal funds, those state funds now that they've been restored, and those are critical. But that's always something that you're worried about, always something that's a concern. Are we going to get the federal and state funding that we need to make sure that survivors in Illinois have the resources they deserve, have the resources they need access to for safety? So that's always an ongoing concern, even if at the moment it feels like we're doing all right, better certainly than we were doing 3 years ago. But it's still always an ongoing concern, and we're certainly seeing a large uptick in the need for our services. We've started a new program with our local police departments that's bringing a lot more people in contact with our agency and connecting them with services sooner, and that goes along with a need for expanded services, expanded space. So there's always a need for more funding.
Gabe, I wanted to ask you, there are people who are listening to this who maybe don't have firsthand experience with this issue, but know that this is unfortunately something that can be common, and they might want to be prepared and be sensitive to help people. What advice would you offer?
Yeah, so I would say when we work with our volunteers and when we hear from clients, the concern that we hear in terms of disclosing to friends and family is this my fault? And will I be believed? Those are kind of the two questions that we see from folks. And so what we tell people when they're working with survivors, when they're handling a disclosure, whether that's in a professional setting or a personal setting, is that we want to let the survivor know that we believe them, and we want to let the survivor know that what happened is not their fault. And then also helping them process those options. And so we talk to our volunteers who work our hotline, and we say, When you're on a hotline call and someone discloses to you, you want to help them process that, but you also want to tell them that it's not their fault, that you believe them, and then something along the lines of, what can I do to support you? We don't want to go into a situation assuming that they're reaching out to the hotline because they want counseling or because they want to prosecute or because they want a civil no contact order or whatever it is, but we want to make them aware of those options and allow them to process that.
Brendan, when we talk about this issue, I think it's often women talking to women about women, even though we know that this is not just an issue that happens to women. I wanted to ask you about what male, in particular the work you do, what you think male students can do on your campus, the kind of work you do to be allies, both in terms of prevention and support.
So, yeah, we do talk about women being the primary victims of sexual violence, and then men also being the primary perpetrators of sexual violence. And one thing that we really try to do with CERC is focusing on making sure that that's not always in the conversation, that we're not using gendered language, because, you know, there are non-binary and gender non-conforming survivors of sexual violence, and there is male sexual violence, and there is female sexual violence. So I think it's really important to kind of just set the groundwork at the beginning of any kind of discussion with not using gendered language, just for the sake of survivors in that room feeling included. But for in terms of what men should be doing, since we are, as a group, kind of the main perpetrators of violence, I think it's mostly focusing on educating yourself. I hear a lot of men who are like, oh, well, I don't really know how to, like, handle sexual assault. I'm afraid that I'm going to be accused. And I'm like, that's really not an issue. I think it's between 2 and 8% for false reporting statistics. So a lot of men are just not educated on the fact that they're not going to, like, be accused of sexual violence. They still just need to educate themselves on, you know, how do you respond to someone when they say, I was assaulted? And how do you do it appropriately? How do you understand what language and what you're saying might be, you know, adversely affecting another person? I mean, there's people who come out of exams and like, oh, this felt like it raped me. And like, how do you not use that language, because it can be directly hurting people around you without you even realizing it. So I think it's just mostly knowing the impact of our words on other people. And that's kind of what we focus on, is just imparting that knowledge that what you say can and does matter to other people.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Brendan. Brendan is a junior at ISU, pre-med in biochemistry, and president of Students Ending Rape Culture on campus there. I want to thank Gabe Kripe for being with us from Stepping Stones, Linnea Erickson-Liskowski from Safe Passage in DeKalb. As they mentioned, they are part of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. If you need help, we will tweet out the website for that, which can refer you to a crisis center near you. If you want to give them a call, that phone number is 217-753-4117. Again, that number for help is 217-753-4117. For tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The death toll for Hurricane Michael stands right now at 17. Dozens are still missing from the storm that made landfall in the Florida Panhandle last week. And over the past year, Americans have heard the names of many tropical storms. Even just think of the past year of Maria, Irma, Harvey. It seems like we're seeing more extreme weather in the news, but how much do we actually know about how these storms form and whether or not our changing climate plays a role in making them worse? Dana Hentz is an Illinois scientist who studies tropical weather. She also teaches atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois and is in studio with us now. Hi, Dana. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So as we've been seeing all these news reports of hurricanes, whether it's this year like Michael or Florence or previous years, I'm thinking about Harvey or Maria. As someone who studies this on a regular basis, what goes through your mind when you see reports of hurricanes on the news?
It's very interesting being, you know, studying the things that I do because two things happen in my brain simultaneously. On one hand, you know, the phenomenon that I study, hurricanes, is happening, and intellectually that's very stimulating because the phenomenon I'm studying is happening in real time and get to watch it evolve and change and the processes that I study happen. On the other hand, a bit of horror always goes through my mind at the same time, in that, especially with a storm like Hurricane Michael, how perfectly formed and how perfectly shaped the storm was really indicative of how powerful the storm was and how dangerous it was. And so watching that perfect structure, meaning that the likelihood that people were going to die was very high. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to deal with emotionally.
I think, yeah, I can certainly imagine that. And as someone, I grew up with hurricanes in Florida. And so when I see a perfectly formed storm, that makes me really nervous. For people who maybe haven't experienced it, what should they know about the power of hurricanes and how they're formed now?
Well, there's a few different things that we look at. And so the main components of a hurricane is that they have a very powerful storm that's really well formed will have a clear center that's known as the eye, surrounded by a ring of clouds that's known as the eye wall. And within the eye wall is both the most intense precipitation, so the rain that's going to come out of the storm, also the strongest winds. As you move away from that, you have these big spiraling arms of rain known as the rain bands. And one thing that's really important to keep in mind is that even though the wind drops off from the eye wall to the outer edges of the storm fairly quickly, we're still dealing with a very wide range of potential impacts that can span over hundreds of miles.
Well, and in fact, we even feel the remnants of storms here in Illinois.
That's right. And as a storm makes landfall, yes, they start to lose power, but you still have all this rain associated with the storm that can often stretch, you know, hundreds of miles inland from the coast.
So one thing we know about hurricanes is that they like warm water. Mm-hmm. So what do we know about the relationship between warmer oceans and stronger storms?
So this is where, you know, when we're thinking about the changes in our ocean temperature, things get a little interesting and complicated, in that on one hand, one thing that we do know for sure is that hurricanes need warm ocean temperatures for their energy. They transfer that energy from that warm ocean water into the wind that keeps the storm going. However, as the ocean temperatures increase, the idea that, well, the storm's power will also increase with that is, you know, that's a scientific.
That's happening, and we know that that's happening. We're seeing ocean temperatures rise, so we know that the storms will be stronger.
The likelihood that the number of storms that are of higher intensity will increase, we are seeing in climate projection that is very likely. The counter to that, however, is that this is things where things get more uncertain, is that the number of storms that we see overall may actually either stay the same or actually go down. So the number of storms that we see may go down, but the number of those storms that are more intense could go up.
Mm.
So it's a very and that has a lot to do with how climate change will also impact where the storms form, how they form, so that those changes in the number of storms that actually turn into hurricanes can change with climate change as well.
Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you about, there was a recent UN climate report that had a lot of warnings, including increased risk of food shortages or wildfires by 2040. How much do we know about the risk for more extreme weather in the immediate future, not just tropical weather?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question, in that it really kind of depends on where you're talking about in the world and what kind of phenomenon, so what kind of severe weather you're talking about. And this, again, goes back to how the atmosphere will adjust with climate change. And so on one hand, so the high and low pressure systems that bring our weather to our region, there's an actual track of storms associated with the jet stream that brings a lot of that weather. Where that track will shift can depend on climate change. There's some possibility that it might shift more north, bringing those storms further north. With the tropical storms, where they go and the regions that they can impact could also change with climate change. And then in terms of temperature extremes, precipitation extremes, especially in terms of intense precipitation or rain events, that's actually one of the biggest concerns, is because actually the amount of moisture that those kinds of storms will have to work with will go up in the atmosphere. So the amount of rainfall that could come out of those systems would also increase.
Mm. So for our listeners who want to be better equipped to understand news, particularly around tropical storms, what are some important things you think people should keep in mind?
I think some things that are important to keep in mind is, again, the size of these systems are very large, and their risks span over hundreds of miles. And so if you're looking at where a storm is going, often a lot of focus is on where the storm center is going to
go. The immediate track, where the eye is going to go.
Exactly. But those impacts can span over large areas. And so trying to keep in mind where that wind, and especially where that water, is going to go. Because one thing that's also really important to keep in mind is that although the winds and hurricanes, like with what happened with Michael, can be very impressive and very, very damaging, the vast majority of the damage and the deaths associated with hurricanes and tropical cyclones is from the water, either by storm surge or inland flooding. And those impacts can span much wider than what you'll see with the wind.
Mm. That's Deanna Hentz. She teaches atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois, studies particularly hurricanes and tropical weather. Thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here today.
What's the wildest thing you've ever been able to wrangle fishing in Lake Michigan? Maybe you've hooked a bass or perch. But last week, Chicago fisherman David Castaneda was kayaking near Waukegan Harbor. He thought he came across salmon, but instead it was a 4-foot-long American alligator. This alligator, obviously an exotic species removed from its natural habitat, which is not Lake Michigan, was most likely someone's discarded pet, especially because the animal was found with its mouth taped shut. It was eventually rescued by Waukegan's Animal Control. Angela Grimes joins us on the line now. She's based in Chicago for the Washington organization, Born Free USA. They're a nonprofit group that's working to end wild animal cruelty. Hi, Angela. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you.
So, Angela, a wild animal from thousands of miles away, how does an alligator end up in Lake Michigan?
The alligator ended up in Lake Michigan because somebody put him there. It's most likely that he was kept as a pet, part of a breeding program, or otherwise, you know, in some sort of private possession, and that person found themselves either unable or unwilling to care for this animal anymore. So rather than do the responsible thing, they taped his mouth shut and dumped him in a lake where he would not be able to survive. It's a very sad situation.
Right. And I know the alligator was found and was very thin. And if someone hadn't found it, obviously that alligator would have died. Can I just ask you, when we say exotic animals and when we talk about exotic animals as pets, I think an alligator is an obvious example. Are there other ones we should be thinking about? What falls into this category?
There are any number of species of wild animals that humans like to keep as pets, mostly for vanity, to show off and just show, I'm pretty cool because I have a monkey, for example, or a lion, or a snake. And one of the most common species to be kept are birds, exotic birds such as parrots, parakeets, and cockatoos from Indonesia, South America, and other countries.
So some of these things are legal to have as pets. Some of them sounds like are also clearly illegal, right? This runs the gamut of both of those for you all?
Absolutely. Illinois has pretty good laws concerning the private ownership of exotic animals. In fact, it has a ban on dangerous wild animals, including big cats, poisonous snakes, and reptiles. But there are some, birds, for example, that are able to be kept as pets. And regardless of the laws, sometimes people just go around them and get these animals through whatever means they can. And unfortunately, each state makes its own laws, even down to the city and county level. So while you might live in a state that bans it, you can drive just across the border and buy an animal there where they aren't banned.
And so when people are thinking about this, so people avoid getting into situations where you have maybe bought a baby alligator and you're dumping it in Lake Michigan. What kind of things do you all suggest people think about before they're purchasing an animal as a pet?
Well, the first thing is to consider that cats and dogs and those rescued in shelters, they're the ones that need homes. And they make the best pets. So the first thing is to do is simply not buy any sort of exotic animal for a pet. That's the easiest and best way to avoid any sort of situation. But if you are in a situation where you do have a monkey or a reptile or any other animal that you can't keep, don't discard them. Don't just set them free.
Don't dump them somewhere.
Exactly. Don't dump them.
But what do you do?
You call a sanctuary. You call your local shelters who can direct you to another agency that can help. You can call Fish and Game or the local Department of Natural Resources for any sort of resource other than just setting them free to die or possibly cause harm to humans and the environment.
Angela, I would suspect people don't call because they don't want to get in trouble, right?
That is very true. It would be a hard phone call to a governing agency if you have an animal illegally, which is why we end up finding alligators in Lake Michigan.
But if you called a shelter, what would that be like?
You know, I think it would depend on what shelter and the person that you're talking to.
Angela, as we wrap up here, I just wonder what final advice you would like people to know about what they can do to help, especially if they see a wild animal, exotic animal that should not belong in Illinois. What should they do?
Sure. If you see or an encounter a wild animal when you're out in the forest preserves or other natural places, the first thing to do is leave that animal alone. And if you are, if you suspect that they are not a native animal or have been, you know, an exotic pet who's dumped, then call the local law enforcement or animal rescue services. And the other thing that you can do for any information on laws or other information regarding the keeping of wild animals, go to bornfreeusa.org and look up some state laws and other information to help educate yourself and other people.
That's Angela Grimes, who's the acting CEO of Born Free USA. They're a nonprofit organization working to end wild animal cruelty. Angela, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, I'll be sitting down with Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. She's the Democratic nominee for the 13th Congressional District. She's hoping to unseat incumbent Republican Rodney Davis. Tune in tomorrow live at 11 for that conversation. And on Thursday, I'll be moderating a debate between the two of them. You can also tune into our website, 21stshow.org, for that if you'd like to hear that live. Our website, as I mentioned, 21stshow.org, is a great place to find our social media handles, to find our Twitter and Facebook links. If you want to contact us by leaving us a voicemail, sending us an email, all you have to remember is 21stshow.org. We've got past shows there as well. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.